Introducing the perfect companion to the Jim Jefferies Show, which had been grabbing late night by the country. The Jim Jefferies Show podcast. Jim Jefferies is an Australian comedian with an inquisitive and sometimes controversial take on American politics and culture. On his new podcast, you're going to get behind-the-scenes look at what happened on the show, including jokes that weren't used or backstory on Jim's international field pieces. I've never met the guy, but he was a hero around these parts for his, I want to say Norm Peterson all the time now, but it's Jordan Peterson.
It's my favorite Comedy Central political show.
There you go. So check it out, folks. You won't want to miss it. Listen to new episodes of the Jim Jefferies Show podcast. It releases every Wednesday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, wherever you listen.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Thursday, August 30th, 2018. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Yes, folks. Did I say that we're live? It's live to tape. I can't even remember. You know why, folks? Because I am just about to go on vacation, and in some respects, I'm already there. I'm already gone. So sorry, but it's true. But even though we're not here, and even though we're not live, we do have an amazing interview for you. I've been talking about this one a lot. I've been referencing it a lot. The distance I've had from the interview, the more it seems to be applicable to me. It's very strange. The book is called Credulity. It is a cultural history of U.S. mesmerism. It is written by an assistant professor of English at the University of Virginia, Emily Ogden. It's a fascinating look at the history of mesmerism from the 1830s, basically up until Reconstruction, and then its application to the American psyche today in its relationship with Donald Trump. So, you know, I don't know what to tell you. But if you can get that anywhere else, good luck to you. Also, for members, you're going to get a Matt's deep archive pick. Or maybe not so deep. We're not sure. You'll have to wait and see. But that will be coming up for members. And just a reminder, you can become a member to this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com and signing up for a membership. We're on vacation all this week. Tomorrow on the program, special surprise. You're going to have to check it out. I know you will not be sorry. And then Monday, we have our special Labor Day show. We will be back live on Tuesday. Going to take a quick break and then come back with Emily Ogden on Credulity, a cultural history of U.S. mesmerism. We are back, Sam Cedar, on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome Emily Ogden. She is an associate professor of English at the University of Virginia and author of Credulity, A Cultural History of U.S. Mesmerism. Emily, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Sam. It's great to be here.
I have to tell you, I've gone through 5 decades now, believing that the word mesmerism meant something. I didn't realize it came from a person.
Yeah, it comes from Franz Anton Mesmer, who invented a science that he called animal magnetism. And he thought that he could direct an invisible fluid into people's bodies and heal them. But people who didn't think he could do that started to make fun of him and call it mesmerism instead after his name. And that's the name that stuck.
So what is mesmerism? I mean, as defined as a sort of, I guess, a meta description of what Franz Mesmer was doing.
So the fastest way for us to get at it today is to say that it was hypnotism, except that it started before hypnotism and it's the ancestor of hypnotism. But when we go to see a stage hypnotist today, or if we even go to see a therapeutic hypnotist today, like somebody who would help us stop smoking, They're practicing something very similar to what mesmerists practiced in the 18th and 19th century. So what they would do is they would make various gestures, sometimes stare straight into people's eyes in a way that we might call mesmerizing in our sense of the word. And then people would go into these trance-like states where the effects really varied. Maybe they would do foolish things like people do when they're hypnotized on stage. Now, maybe they would find that their sort of mysterious illnesses started to feel better. Some of them even said that they could become clairvoyant. And so it was a range of different activities, but all of them had to do with the idea that this bond with the mesmerist, maybe mediated by a strange fluid, gave you unusual abilities and sometimes gave the mesmerist control over you.
If you had asked me a couple of weeks ago, I would have assumed that this was part of a tradition that was thousands of years old in some fashion, like that it had something to do with witch doctors or shamans or something to that effect. Is it there was a certain amount of show involved in this that made it different, or was it that dynamic of just like one person being able to sort of impact another person, as opposed to one person just doing it because they've taken, I don't know, some type of hallucinogen or something
like
that?
Well, it's a really good question, because it actually is a question people have been asking since the very beginning, when Franz Anton Mesmer showed up and started shooting animal magnetism into people's bodies. The people who wanted to debunk him said, this is just shamanism, and it's what's been done by quote-unquote primitive people since time immemorial, according to these debunkers. And then mesmerists themselves would say, well, we actually, we're not just recycling the practices of shamans and, as you said, witch doctors. We are subjecting those to a new rational approach. So we're doing what those priests thought they were doing through magic, we're actually doing through science. So it is, according to both sides, both the debunkers and the practitioners, like magical practices, but in one case, you know, the debunkers think it's like them in that it's a fraudulent version of them, and then the practitioners say it's like them in that it's a scientific version of them, sort of like we would say chemistry is a scientific version of alchemy.
That dynamic, I think, is the one that I find really fascinating. The relationship between the practitioners and the debunkers, and it almost is like it gets to the point where it's like a snake eating its own tail. At one point, it sort of feels
that's
like.
That's right.
And we'll get there. I want to because this has you wrote an opinion piece about Donald Trump in the New York Times that I'd like to sort of land on in a bit, because that is there's a lot of incredible insight, I think, to understand this dynamic and how, from a political sense, we can capitalize on it, which is in some ways also reminiscent of the book and the story of the mesmerist in a way. So tell us a dynamic of that. Like, there's Dodds and Grimes, I think, and there's also Stone and Brackett. Like, just you can choose whichever dynamic, you know, whichever couple you want. Give us an example of that dynamic as, you know, we go past the Benjamin Franklin debunking Mesmer.
Yeah, it's exactly as you say. The really interesting thing about mesmerism is that you sometimes find that the practitioner and the debunker are saying almost exactly the same thing, that mesmerism is an art of deception. But for one, that makes it a fraud, and for the other, that makes it a legitimate science. So let me talk about the people that I talked about in my New York Times piece, which is titled Donald Trump, Mesmerist. And those are, as you said, J. Stanley Grimes and John Bovee Dodds. And from a certain perspective, these guys both end up being mesmerists, but Grimes starts out as a debunker. So what Grimes did was that he watched this other mesmerist, a third guy, whose name was J.R. Buchanan, mesmerizing people. And Grimes said to himself, the physical theories underlying this practice are complete bunk. What Buchanan claimed he was doing was that he was touching different parts of the skull of the subject, and as a result, he would elicit these different performances of personality. So he would get a big, tough guy to pretend to nurse and fondle a child by touching a certain part of his brain, and he would get a woman who was known to be timid to be quite strident by touching another part of her brain. And of course, there are sort of gender stereotypes that he was playing with here. And what Grimes said was, this has nothing to do with touching parts of the brain. He's indicating to the subjects what he wants from them, and he's getting it. And that's what we would call hypnotic suggestion. So this is a real phenomenon that you can get people to kind of fall into line with what you're saying by telling them a certain story about it. But Grimes didn't stop at debunking. He started actually doing these things on stage too, but he was sort of trying to show that Buchanan had the theory wrong, but then he started to develop his own theory.
All right, now, let me just add
yeah,
here.
Sure.
We're talking about the 1850s here now.
Yeah,
just so
good
that
point.
We can...
Yeah, yeah. It's important to say this is not going on now, although it almost seems like it could be. But yes,
yes.
1850s.
And
1840s, 1850s.
I want to just make explicit the difference here. Buchanan is basically saying there is a completely physical, a biological explanation for what's happening with the behavior of these people. I'm pressing a certain part of the brain and I'm triggering it, and it's a physiological response on some level. Whereas Grimes is debunking it by saying, no, this is just simply a psychological almost trick, if you will.
Well, it would be nice if it were that simple, but it wasn't quite, because Grimes actually thought there was a physiological response too, but he thought it was much simpler and didn't have to do with certain areas of the brain. He thought it had to do with just one area of the brain. And so the whole scientific cachet of Buchanan's idea would have just dissolved at a touch if Grimes was right, because the whole point for Buchanan was that he could localize parts of the brain almost like we would do with an fMRI now through mesmerism. And Grimes was saying, no, you can't do that. But then the third person who came along, John Bowlby Dodds, just sort of dropped the whole question of whether this was true or whether this was false, the fact that Grimes was a debunker, and he took Grimes's new version of the practice, put a new physical fluid back in, and just ran with it as a new form of mesmerism. And Grimes spent a good part of the rest of his life trying to get people to quit listening to Dodds and realize that Dodds had plagiarized and at the same time reversed him and taken his debunking out, and no one really seemed to care. So on these different sides, the positions that they were actually articulating or saying out loud were so similar that a mesmerist could plagiarize a debunker, and yet on some level they were meant to be opposites. You know, one was a skeptic and the other wasn't. And so that's the dynamics that most interests me in the book. How do we get this practice that looks exactly the same, whether you're debunking it or you're doing it?
And I mean, let's talk about it from the perspective of the audience. Like, and maybe before we get that, we should maybe also talk about Charles Poyon, who I guess found a different application for this stuff, right? Like, I mean, is there a different, like, when we see this? Let's talk about the applications in the relationship with the audience, I guess, because in some instances it seems to be like I'm putting on a show or you know, or an exhibit, I guess, of, you know, a biological discovery. And then in other areas, it's used in sort of like very practical application, supposedly.
That's right. Yeah, good point. So the first application was medical cure, sort of like people thought that they could cure diseases at this time, possibly by applying electricity to people's bodies. They thought they could use mesmerism to cure people. And Poyon, who's the founder of mesmerism and was active, founder of mesmerism in the U.S., I should say, and was active about 15 to 20 years before Grimes and Dodds and Buchanan. He did cures. He did do some lecturing to large audiences, but nothing like the big theatrical displays that you would see later. And the other thing that it was used for, too, and this was a really important use in the 19th century, much as we might want to dismiss it now, was in order to produce clairvoyance. So there were very famous, usually women, who, when they were mesmerized, they would become able to see things that they couldn't see at other times. And people would go and ask them questions and ask them to diagnose their illnesses, ask them, in one case at least, this was imagined, what the price of cotton was in the South before the news could actually get there by newspaper from the South to the North. So the uses were really, really varied, and some of them are still consonant with what we think of as being the mainstream use of hypnosis today, that it's a stage spectacle or a cure, and some of them are less so, like clairvoyance.
I was interested too in Poyen's using it, or attempted to use it, for basically his, I want to say workers, but it's really slaves. I mean, to just mention that, tell us about that just briefly, because he was a plantation owner himself.
Poyen was French, and he was born in the French colony of Guadeloupe, and he learned about mesmerism in medical school in France, and then he returned to Guadeloupe, where he saw his fellow planters mesmerizing their enslaved laborers. And so he seems to have seen it as a kind of a labor management technique. When he brought it to the U.S., he brought it to factory cities almost as though he thought it could be used as a way to pacify or control workers in the U.S., although it never was applied on an institutional scale.
Supposedly. I'm sorry.
Yeah, maybe it was never written down. We certainly have no evidence that it was applied on an institutional scale.
So let's move forward. So after, does this just keep, like, the cycle keeps chasing itself? Or how does the field, if it were, develop from there?
Well, it does sort of keep cycling for many decades. And then what seems to happen is less that mesmerism is finally established or debunked, which was what people were waiting for, that at one point or another one side would win out. Instead, it gets absorbed into seance spiritualism, which was a practice of going into a trance and contacting the dead, and sometimes speaking as the dead or writing as the dead. So when we think of spirit mediums, that's basically what we're thinking of. So mesmerism was absorbed into that practice. It was absorbed into other 19th century and early 20th century occult practices. And in that sense, it's distantly come down to us today in the ways that those various occult practices are still alive. It just sort of lost its grip on people on both sides as a question that had to be debated as spiritualism became the more pressing concern. Could people contact the dead or couldn't they?
So I want to just take a slight detour. It's a little bit different for this show. We generally just talk about politics, but I think that there is a relationship here, and particularly based upon sort of an online version of politics that are occurring. The relationship between secularization and modernity, and the sort of the tension that was there with people wanting to become modern and secularized on some time, particularly in this era. And it wasn't just happening in the United States. I mean, we see it with the emancipation of the Jews in Germany. I mean, across the world, the 19th century in many respects became, obviously the there was an antecedent in the centuries before. But this notion of how do you take what was a religious impetus and secularize it, and much of it is that, and because I want to get to a quote from the Coda, I guess, because it is eerily reminiscent of like what I've experienced in sort of talking about new atheists online and sort of where they bring. But just discuss that a little bit for us, because it's that tension and how sort of secularism in some ways took the husk, if you will, of religion in some ways and just refilled it with something else.
Yeah, that's a really interesting metaphor. You know, the way that I think of it is that secularism is this thing that's never fully achieved, except at the moment when it's debunking religion. I guess that's one way that you might put it. And so, and I should maybe even say less religion than bad religion, because there are some kinds of religion that, in a secularist framework, can look perfectly fine and perfectly rational, but other kinds that don't. So mainline Protestantism in the U.S. is usually relatively compatible, maybe up until the point of the New Atheists, with a secularist consensus, whereas things like mesmerism aren't. So the way I think of it is that if you want to be secular, you need to find a credulous dupe who you can exercise your secularism on, so that you can say, that guy is still pre-modern, but I'm not. I'm over here. I'm the modern one. And that's what mesmerists, in effect, offered as a package deal in their practice. They said, you know, we're going to take these subjects that we mesmerize, and we're going to work on them in exactly the same way that bad religion has always worked on people. But we're going to let that position that we're occupying of working on those people be a scientific one. We're going to have a science of duping people, a science of using credulous people. And so it really captures for me what is often present in a secularist moment, which is that religion is still there. It's just been placed in scare quotes, or it's been contained and deployed and pointed at in these particular ways.
Yeah, I mean, let me read that quote, and which I think mm-hmm. teases that out a little bit, too. There is no special reason why you'd be freer from your idol when your idol is your freedom of choice than when it is your little wooden god. The problem mm-hmm. with that, the empowerment argument, is it assumes that freedom is a better master.
Mm-hmm.
Like the idea of you're throwing the yoke off, but whatever it is you're using to throw your yoke off, it becomes your new master.
That's right. Yeah. And usually when we think of ourselves as free agents or as having self-control, you know, we're identifying ourselves with that controlling part of ourselves. But there's another part of ourselves, evidently, that's under control. And so the two are always going to be present. You don't have control without a controlled thing. And as you were reading in that quote, I don't know if we want to assume that the various different types of control, whether they are spiritual or religious or occult, or whether they are secular and rational and having to do with agency, I don't know if we want to assume that their structure is totally different or that they don't have anything to do with each other.
I mean, because my just from my experience in seeing these arguments as they play out, that rationality is sort of wielded as almost this sort of magical device that as soon as you say that your argument is rational, it immediately is, you know, the functional equivalent of like, oh, the reason why I'm king is because God said so.
Yeah. Yeah, there can be too, and this is something I talk about in the book, there can be a real pleasure in being the debunker. So some of the earliest debunkings of a mesmerism-like science had to do with debunking perkinism, which was a way of curing people by holding metal wands to their body. And one guy tried to show that this was false by painting some wooden rods to look like metal and then holding them to people's bodies and showing people would respond in exactly the same way that they did to the metal. And he remembered applying these wands with what he called necromantic gestures while trying not to laugh. And so you can see the enjoyment of the debunker in that quote, you know, that it's really fun to be the one who knows and the one who's rational. And the easiest way to enjoy that pleasure is to find somebody else who can be the one who doesn't know and the one who isn't rational, and then just point at that person.
I mean, and to be fair, I think to a certain extent, we do this on this show, or I do this on this show about, a significant portion of the population who I think does not, that can be categorized in a bunch of different ways, that I just think that, you know, we who listen to the show are smarter than them and they're doing it wrong. And
Yeah. We all do it. I mean, you know, we all do it to some extent. And I think I do it too. And I I think that we do it on the left and we do it on the right. But it's worth thinking about what the benefits are of just occupying that stylistic position. And we do see it, you know, at first, in our sort of recent political moment, it seemed like it was going to be the left move to say there's those people who don't have possession of the truth and we're the ones who do. But now it's being practiced on both sides. And it's a surprisingly portable little move to make, as mesmerists saw. As soon as somebody made it against them, they made it against somebody else, and they made it back against that person. And it's a kind of a style as well as a set of facts. And the style can sometimes be pretty disconnected from the facts.
I want to talk about Trump because you have some sort of fascinating insights in your editorial about Trump along these lines, about the idea of exposing Trump's lies in some ways, whether, you know, he's conscious of it or not, plays into his hands, or it sees, because the followers of Trump, or the supporters, I guess you could call them, like him because he's on their side. Like he is,
yeah.
He's on that sort of like circle of debunking. And we saw this during the campaign, right? He's like, I know these guys because I've dealt with the politicians. I know how corrupt they are. I know how duplicitous they are because I'm actually part of how, you know, I was part of that process. But now I'm letting you into that process. I'm not ending it. It's just like now I'm doing it on your behalf.
Yeah, that's right. And I should be clear. I think it's really vital work that journalists do when they fact check. You know, I'm as a scholar, I'm deeply committed to fact checking. Whenever I make a claim in my own writing, I do the best that I can to make sure that it's true. But I do think that it's worth explaining why
it doesn't matter.
There can be this. Yeah. Why doesn't the ground just start to shake when some of these lies are exposed? Because sometimes it seems like it really should. And I think mesmerism does provide a way to think about that, that if you just believe that you're living in a world of lies and liars, then the only person who could possibly be telling some part of the truth is the person who at least admits to having lied before. And the only person who could possibly help you or be a reasonable guide and protector for you is someone who understands how to lie. It's sort of like on a detective show that you know, your cop can't be a Pollyanna. He or she has to be someone who understands the underside of life. And I think Trump is, as you say, consciously or unconsciously, I have no idea. I don't know what his conscious strategy may or may not be, but I think he is benefiting from some kind of dynamic like that.
And I like in that piece where you wrote, instead of being one of the dupes, you could be one of the mesmerists. It's as if Trump is saying all you had to do was sign up for a private class. And then, that's basically Trump University, right? Like that was literally.
That would have been a good thing to put in. That would have been great.
I mean, that's basically what it was. Like, I have lived this life of semi-corrupt real estate practices. And for an extraordinary amount of money, I can teach you how to be just as corrupt.
Yeah. I mean, I think there might be a worldview out there where there are only scenes of deception, and that's what you're living all the time, is people are trying to take advantage of you, if not actually outright lie to you. And the only way to be on top is to be the deceiver instead of the deceived. And this is something that I try to explain in my book through the work of a lot of other scholars of secularity who have actually seen that as a kind of key part of the secular, that you're always the dupe or the con man, in effect, the manipulator, the puller of the strings, and you want to make sure that you're the puller of the strings, even if that means that you have to practice a little deception of your own.
Lastly, like what of the dupes though? I mean, there's a lot of a decent amount of clinical research about that says 25% of North America is consists of right wing authoritarians. A smaller amount are left wing authoritarians, but they are the sort of the classic dupes for this type of situation, right? The whole story is not just the guy or gal on stage. It's those people in the audience who, you know, for whom this fulfills something. What do you have to say about those people?
Well, in the book, it gets a little complicated, and here the parallel is not so helpful, I think, in understanding the present moment, or maybe it is, but in a way that I don't yet know how to tease out. In a lot of cases, when you actually look at someone who is the quote-unquote dupe of a mesmerist, that person is actually controlling things in his or her own way and has his or her own agenda and is getting his or her own needs met in various ways by the situation. So, for example, there's a clairvoyant who I talk about, Lorena Brackett, who was a middle to lower class blind woman in Providence, Rhode Island, who ended up having these incredible gifts as a clairvoyant traveler. She would travel in spirit to other cities. And some people at the time would have called her a fraud, and some people would have called her the dupe of her mesmerists. But you could also say that given the range of very limited options available to her as a blind woman in 1830s New England, mesmerism was actually not the worst. She did these kind of improvisational performances. She had the opportunity to talk to some interesting people. She lived in some interesting places as a result. And so sometimes when we really look at the thing from the dupe's perspective, it fractures into a range of individual motivations that are not so easily described as just some idiot conned by a mastermind.
There's some element maybe of hope, as sort of maybe perverse as it is, if you have a champion, right? There's theoretically some hope that that you're going to win.
That the dupe will win, you mean?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You sign up for a movement, there has to be, you know, even if it's around this guy, it is, I guess it gives you some sense of empowerment.
Yeah, that's right. And sometimes, at least with the mesmerists, I think this is different when the person we're talking about is the president of the United States. So again, I don't think the parallel holds up so well here. But with the mesmerists, you know, these were not people who had an enormous amount of social or political power. They were generally a bit more powerful than the subjects that they worked on, but not even always that. And so there was room for some give and take and some improvisation in the actual application of these practices in a lot of cases. And so there's some hope there for at least the dupes, so to speak, of mesmerists. If it doesn't, I don't see my way fully to getting hope about the present out of that situation.
Now,
but definitely for the mesmerist subjects, there was the possibility that it would turn out better for them than debunkers thought.
Are the dupes just the people who are directly impacted by the mesmerists, or are the dupes the people who are watching the person who's being a subject of a mesmerist?
You know, I think that this idea of a dupe, it only came up in debunkers' accounts, of course. You know, mesmerists didn't see it this way in quite the same way. And it could really vary. So there were some debunkings where people said that the mesmerist was the dupe and the clairvoyant was the mastermind. And then, as you say, sometimes it was that audiences had been conned by the mesmerist and the clairvoyant together, or by just one of them. So that too was a moving target. It really depended on who the particular debunker was who was applying that kind of language to the situation.
And maybe it's just a function of history. I mean, we could all end up being the dupes. If things go south.
Yeah, I mean, when we look back at a practice like mesmerism now, there are a lot of elements of it that just seem really unpersuasive on their face because of our current understanding of the brain or of magnetism and electricity. And a lot of those things at the time, even to people who didn't believe in mesmerism, to a lot of them, those things seemed at least superficially plausible in a way that has to do with historical change for sure.
Emily Ogden, the book is Credulity, A Cultural History of U.S. Mesmerism. Thank you so much for your time today. We'll put a link to your book at majority.fm. And once again, I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Sam. It's been a pleasure.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light's shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice was made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101.